Yes, yes. Good morning, everybody. Hope you're doing well. Stefan Molyneux from Freedomain. Over the next couple of weeks, donate at freedomain.com/donate. You get my entire almost 12-hour presentation on the history, causes, and effects of the French Revolution, one of the greatest truth abouts that has ever come out of my spotty noggin, and I hope you will check it out. That's freedomain.com/donate. All right. Questions from freedomain.locals.com. Recently noticed some of the most vocal advocates on places like LinkedIn for work from home have been women. They say they want flexibility, they want breaks on their schedule, they want to go for walks and cook their own fresh food at home. Then it occurred to me, they used to have all of this when they were homemakers, so they're perfectly happy to be and work at home, just not for their families, right? Look, I mean, I understand. I understand and I sympathize with the frustration that people have regarding modern women. But please, please, please do not turn against your mother's wives, sisters, and aunts because of government education and media propaganda. It is, I mean, I've had the enormous privilege. I live with two females, right? I have a wife, I have a daughter, and I, of course, work from home. So I have had the enormous privilege for 22 years to live with my wife and for almost 16 years to live with my daughter, well, I guess almost 17 if you count gestation. And women are amazing. Women are wonderful. Women are fantastic. Now, the idea that there's something wrong with women or women are just hypocrites and this and that and the other, it's like it's not taking into account the power that has been inflicted on them, the groupthink that has been inflicted on them. And this is particularly true if you're a white male. You have had negative programming in a lot of ways, sort of hostility. But if you're a female, you get praised and courted and manipulated and subtly threatened and so on all the time. And also, if you're a youthful and relatively attractive female, particularly on the internet, you get unbelievable amounts of deference and offers and gifts and simps and wannabes and you know, marry me and I'll fly you here and people offering you money for your attention and time. It's a crazy world for women. And you know, if you know anyone who can survive and flourish under that kind of mental assault and distorted reality, you know somebody who's not a human being. You would be susceptible to it. I would be susceptible to it. So the fact that the regime is more hostile to men and more courting of women, one of the things that does is it makes men frustrated and annoyed with women, rather than seeing that the women of their society are under a kind of ideological bribery and threat and assault from media as a whole and from the educational system as a whole. And the idea that that would have us turn on each other rather than, you know, question the foundation, nature, and manifestation and morals of the powers that are in the world, I think is a fundamental mistake. It's sort of like somebody who goes crazy in a concentration, take an extreme example, like somebody who goes crazy in a concentration camp. Do we just look at them and say, well, they're just nuts? They're just nuts. Well, it depends. I mean, have they been in the concentration camp a lot longer? Have they been tortured more? There's a whole lot of things that need to, before you just start saying, well, the problem at the concentration camp are the people who go crazy, not the fact that there's a concentration camp. That is getting you to turn on your fellow victims, in a sense. Women are victims of propaganda. Women are victims of mind programming. Women are victims of media falsehoods and and so on. And you say, ah, yes, but a lot of women are victimized by other women. And that is certainly true. That is true. That is true. Now, the reason for that is quite powerful. If you look around the world, there are various cultures. And how are the cultures enforced? The cultures are largely enforced by women. Why? Because culture has to be embedded in the personality quite early. And who is it, historically, evolutionarily speaking, who is it who has dealt with infants and toddlers? It is women. Women have dealt with infants and toddlers. Now, you need to imprint the culture on the babies and toddlers through aggression, sometimes violence, but usually it is through affection and ostracism, right? That is how culture is imprinted on us when we're little. And I'm sure you can remember all of this stuff from when you were very little, that it's like you get the yay, good job, and hugs if you do something that your mother wants. And if you do something that really displeases your mother, you get the cold shoulder, you get rejection, you get cold looks, you get this kind of threat of ostracism, which, you know, babies deep down experience as a potential death threat, because if your parents don't like you, you can't survive. Maybe you get spanking, maybe you get yelled at, but maternal affection and withdrawal is what is used to guide children into the correct channels of culture, to get them on the train track of culture. And you can see this, of course. You know, you get some kid who's brought up in Japan. It's an Asian kid, right? Brought up in Japan becomes one way. Brought up in California becomes another way. And we say, ah, yes, but that has to do with the entire social culture. It's like, yes, 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 it does. It does. But the people in the culture are also raised by women, and the people who make TV shows are also raised by women, and they get a particular kind of imprinting. So when you look at the varieties of cultures around the world, what you're looking at is the infliction of culture, or the, you could say, the enforcement of culture, or however you want to put it. It is the imprinting of culture on babies and toddlers by women using quite aggressive forms of emotional bribery, manipulation. And then you say, ah, yes, but women shouldn't emotionally bribe and manipulate. And I get all of that. I understand that. That's what peaceful parenting is all about and all of that. But if we look at how we have evolved, we've evolved in competing tribes, right? We've evolved in competing tribes and opposing and aggressive tribes. So what is it that makes you want to fight for your tribe, right? Because if there's a tribe that says, well, the moment we start losing, we're just going to switch sides, that tribe does not last very long. So there has to be something, you know, like this 300 Spartans fighting to the death. There has to be something that has you fight for your tribe beyond reason, right? There has to be something that has you want to fight for your tribe beyond reason, beyond a rational calculation. And that something is culture. It is your ancestors. It is your God. It is your belief system. It's your morals. It's your virtues. Like, we are the greatest. We are the best. Those have almost never throughout human evolution anything to do with morality. It's like, why do you cheer for your sports team rather than, oh, my sports team wears red sweaters and or jerseys. The other sports team wears green jerseys. So you're actually cheering on clothing. Like, you're cheering on clothing. It's nothing to do with you in particular. In fact, quite often you're bribed, taxed, and pillaged in order to pay for sports teams and stadiums and so on. So for a tribe to compete, what has evolved, and to win or at least hold its own against other tribes, what has evolved is an irrational in-group preference, not based on morality, but based on culture, our way of life, our culture, what we do. That is the best, that is the greatest, our gods, our ancestors, our tribal abstraction, the collective, the Borg, whatever you want to call it, that which is not empirical is worth dying for. That which is not empirical. Right? Culture is not empirical. It's not like a, you know, a cabinet or a chair or a tree. It is not empirical. So that which is not empirical, that which does not exist, is worth dying for. Now, that's a very powerful thing when it comes to war, because if you're facing those warriors, like the famous sort of Norse warriors, right, that they fight and die because death in battle gets you the eternal party town of Valhalla. And so there are the Norse warriors, the Vikings, and other kinds of warriors where they are half in love with death, that they're willing to fight and die, like the kamikazes in the Second World War out of Japan. They're willing to die for that which does not exist, right? The holiness of the emperor, or the watching and waiting ancestors who are there to greet you, and so on. So culture is inflicted by women. Religion tends to be transmitted by women, which is why when you get women into the workforce, you don't get the transmission of religion as much. You get the transmission of a different collectivism, which is more secular and state-based. So women transmit culture through emotional aggression and reward, right? Hugs and get away from me, or kisses versus scorn and verbal rejection. So your children flow into the carved tracks of culture through the aggression and affection of the females. Now, females themselves do not invent culture. Like, nobody invents culture. It's something that's like nobody invents language. It's something that evolves over time. So women have to have culture inflicted on them before they can inflict culture on their children. So when women are children, the culture is inflicted upon them. And women are usually not allowed, in human evolution, women are not allowed to deviate much from culture. Men, we have a certain amount of liberty with regards to culture. And we're allowed to wander a little and not be quite so conformist. And women are not given that same privilege. So men can divide themselves into subgroups as boys, you know, in high school, like the nerds, the jocks, the brainers, the teacher's pets, the band kids, that, you know, like we can go into different subcultures and we get some choice. Girls don't have that as much. They don't have that as much. There's more collective punishment and ostracism. And girls go through a particular kind of agony with regards to ostracism that boys often don't. I mean, it's not fun for boys either, but there's always some group you can usually find. And even if you're a bit of a loner, it's not the end of the world. And that's because culture has to be both incredibly stable in the long run. It has to be both incredibly stable and subject to evolution. These are the two poles that really challenge society. And I talked about some of this in my tour of Australia and then not New Zealand back in 2018. So culture has to be very stable in order to be reproduced and to be believable. Like, if your ancestors lived the same way that you live, you talk about like 6,000 years of Chinese culture, there was incredible stability. I mean, I don't mean to say that there were no wars or revolutions or famine. Of course there was, but in terms of the general culture and the cultural approach, it was not wildly different. Look at European culture. It changes every 100 years, 200, 300 years. There's a huge change. But if you look at 6,000 years of Chinese culture, there was, compared to, say, European culture, there's a huge amount of stability. So cultures that are stable have to have some elements of evolution in them. And who is allowed to evolve culture? It generally tends to be men. Thinkers, philosophers, scientists, challengers, iconoclasts. We're just allowed a little bit more latitude and a little bit more leeway to affect culture. Women are usually not allowed that, and in part it's because other women enforce it. Men as a whole, you know, we don't care that much about culture, politeness, appropriate, inappropriate. We're not sort of micromanaging policers of the status quo. we're a little bit more rough and tumble. We're a little bit more let it go, let it be. I don't know, maybe, maybe not. But women tend to be the ones who micromanage correct and incorrect behavior to the point where you end up with this culture. What is considered good? What is considered bad? What is considered right? What is considered wrong? And so on, right? I mean, you think of the, in some cultures, to burp is to express your appreciation for the meal, right? But in certainly in the cultures that I grew up in, burping was horrifying. Like, it was considered absolutely appalling behavior. Now, why are women so concerned with culture? Well, they need culture so that men have something to fight for. Because if the men aren't willing to fight, or at least the perception is that men aren't willing to fight to the death, then other cultures will attack them, right? So if you've got tribe A and tribe B, and tribe A knows that the men of tribe B will surrender and switch sides the moment that they start losing, they have a much greater incentive to attack tribe B than if they know that tribe B is full of fanatical, crazed psycho warriors who will fight for, you know, until 3 minutes after they're dead. They're more likely to leave them alone, right? There is this sort of battle technique or fighting technique, which is to show how willing you are to commit self-harm. You know, like if I'm willing to beat my own head against a tree before a battle, then clearly I'm going to be a rather crazy guy to fight, and maybe you should stay away, right? It's sort of, this shows up, faint echoes of this show up in Fight Club when Tyler Durden gets beaten up by the guy who's upset about the basement being used for Fight Club. If you're willing to endure pain, you're a dangerous opponent in battle. So women need to create these abstract cathedrals of sacrifice called culture. The gods, the ancestors, the tribe, the collective, the way of life, the morals, the worldview, whatever it is. And so if women are able to create a credible collectivist culture that men are willing to die for, then women are much better protected. So women, by raising children to obey culture and transmitting culture, they're creating kind of a shield around themselves, which is now the culture is something that is so powerful that men are willing to fight and die to preserve it, to preserve the tribe, and that means to preserve their women. So for women to inflict culture on children is to raise children, and particularly boys, who are much more likely to protect them, to fight to the death, or at least to have that reputation. Because if you have the reputation, right, peace through superior firepower, if you have the reputation of being, you know, crazy people who will die for their cause, you tend to, well, your culture tends to be left alone. People tend not to criticize, they tend not to invade or attack and so on, because it's just, you know, this endless wave of people who will die for their collective concepts. So women are protecting themselves by inflicting culture. But culture is not invented by women, neither is it invented by particular men. Women are not allowed to deviate much from culture, because if you start to mess with the culture, then you fragment the unity of the tribe, because you have the younger generation who believes different things from the older generation. You can see this, of course, happening in the present with the okay boomer stuff and the resentment that the young have towards the old, which is engineered and so on. So if you try to evolve the culture and change the culture, you hit the resistance of women, because when the tribe is fragmented, the women are less protected from more unified external tribes, right? So you can get mad at women for this kind of groupthink stuff and so on. But also, women, of course, put a lot more resources into the having and raising of children than men do, right? Now, of course, men will train their sons on how to be a good provider, a good hunter, a good farmer, whatever it's going to be. Men will train their sons on how to provide, usually starting from the age of 7 onwards. But the men also get value from the children out in the hunt, right? So the children might be used as noisemakers or beaters to drive the game towards the male hunters and so on, right? So whereas babies are a net negative for women in terms of energy and resources and so on. Like you're pregnant, that can go badly. You can get an ectopic pregnancy. The umbilical cord can be wrapped around the neck. You can die in childbirth. It's very risky. And you can have trouble healing. You can get an infection after a childbirth. You can get mastitis, which is infections of the breasts with regards to breastfeeding. I mean, and even if all of that happens, which should often happen fine, but even if all of that goes well, then you're getting up a couple of times a night. You are losing calories through breastfeeding, and your sexual market value has plummeted, of course. You're very vulnerable to your man's whims and preferences and whether he's going to feed you or not. So it's all a net negative for women in the short run. Of course, in the long run, it works out. If it does work out, sorry, that's a bit of a tautology. Hey, this is my big philosophical insight. You see, it works out. If it does, in fact, work out, ooh, big brain. Stand back and knock over the camera. So men get resources. If a man is teaching his son farming, then the son is helping, right? Even if it's as little as, you know, putting the pig slops in or doing some weeding or chasing away some birds or whatever it is. The farmer is getting some value. The male farmer is getting some value from teaching his son farming as some reciprocal labor. And it escalates and scales up pretty quickly. I'm sure everyone's been to those convenience stores and restaurants where there's like a kid behind the register, right? And whereas women are just not getting resource return. So where does the resource return come for the women? Well, the resource return for the women comes when their children grow up and are themselves sexually successful, right? They grow up, they pair bond, they get married, they reproduce, and that's the payoff for women, which is why little girls dream of their wedding day and little boys don't, right? So for mothers, the payoff is when the women and when their sons and daughters grow up to get married and have their own children. Now, if there are these cultural norms in the society and they do not bully and bribe their children into following these cultural norms in an automatic and internalized way, which is not, this is how we do things, but rather, this is the right thing to do, right? So you understand, this isn't a local thing, right? This isn't a local thing. It isn't, well, burping is fine, we just don't particularly do it. There has to be a horror of burping, or whatever it is that is occurring, right? That is culturally specific. And so it has to be at a moral level. This is the right, this is the good, this is the noble, this is the heroic, this is the virtuous, this, like, it's not just this is how we do things over here. It has to be, this is the right, the good, the noble, the heroic, and all of that sort of stuff. And so it has to be inflicted morally. And if women fail to do that, if they raise, let's say, daughters who are rebels and iconoclasts and don't conform once there's a line from some movie about some people march to the beat of their own drum. Rosalinda has her own brass band or something, like, she just being an iconoclast, being different, being oppositional, being your own, like, rebel girl. This is really pushed, right? Rebel girl is pushed. And why is rebel girl women who don't conform, women who she just said no, women who go their own way, women who rebel, and so on. This is really being pushed and has been for the last 50 or 60 years. Well, if in evolutionary terms, if a woman has raised a daughter to be oppositional to culture, then she's far less likely to find a mate. She's far less likely to find a mate. And so that means that her investment in her child was a massive net loss, because she had the child so that her child could also have children later on in life and the bloodline could continue. And so for a woman, for a mother, the infliction of culture by any means necessary is the best way to ensure future reproductive success. Future reproductive success. Because a future reproductive success is not achieved, it is the equivalent of your children dying. I just need you to understand, this is really, really important to understand what's going on for women. So for women, if you raise your children and your children do not reproduce in the future. They are rejected, ostracized. Nobody will pair bond them with them. Nobody will have sex with them. Nobody will help them raise children or invest in them. And even if somebody will have sex with them, it doesn't mean that those children will survive because there won't be a provider and all of that. So women's drive to instill culture in their offspring is as strong as their desire to keep their children alive. Because a child that grows up outside of the culture, oppositional to the culture, is much less likely to reproduce throughout human evolution, which is why you see this incredible copy-paste Groundhog Day repetition of culture. I mean, why is it that the Chinese culture for thousands of years remained relatively stable? I mean, to some degree, due to isolation, to some degree, due to other geopolitical factors, but in general, it had to do with the fact that there were rebels within the Chinese culture. They just either got killed, or they got ostracized, or they just didn't reproduce, which meant those revolutionary genes, to whatever degree there's genetic oppositional defiant disorder, or questioning, or a desire to escape the matrix of culture, they just didn't make it. It didn't make it. And so that would be pretty clear. So the tiger moms phenomenon, and I know I'm generalizing about Asian culture, so forgive me for that. I know there's differences. But in general, the sort of tiger mom phenomenon, you have to do it this way or I'm going to be really harsh and cold with you, that comes about because if you don't get your daughters in particular to toe the line with regards to culture, then they're not going to get married. They're not going to get married. And because they're going to be oppositional, they're going to be difficult. Men don't want to deal with them because men are already dealing with harsh nature and hunting and war and farming and disasters and bad weather and bad crops and pests and rain and predators. They're already dealing with all of that. They don't want to go home and fight with a wife as well. So they need a wife who's going to... And what are you fighting for, right? You're fighting for your culture. Because if you're not fighting for your culture, then you're going to surrender when you start to lose, in which case you just... that's going to get wiped out overall. So sorry, I know this is kind of a complicated thing and it's probably worth listening to this a couple of times. I apologize for whatever mistakes or tangents I've put forward in trying to get this idea across. But you understand that if you have any value for your culture, you have to understand that the culture is transmitted through female conformity and groupthink. Female conformity and groupthink. And women are susceptible to ostracism because ostracism means they can't reproduce. Ostracism is a predator. Ostracism is a predator towards your genetics. It is a form of lineage slaughter to be ostracized. And this is why ostracism is so powerful in the human mind. If you are ostracized, as I've said on this show many times before, but it's been a while, so I'll repeat it here. Ostracism activates the same parts of the human mind that are activated by torture, physical torture, because it makes your entire parental investment and the investments of your ancestors without purpose if you don't reproduce. They wouldn't bother. Like, they wouldn't bother. So this is, of course, a fairly lengthy way of answering the question, why was it so easy to convince women to go and serve a boss rather than a husband and their children? You've got to serve somebody, right? And why? So the reason is that the moment that women were told by older women, and you can sort of think of Steinem and the other sort of feminists of the 1950s and the 1960s, again, this is all calculated, very little of it is accidental, but the moment that women were told by older women that housework is meaningless, work is where it's at, don't be a broodmare, don't just be wiping kids' butts when you could go and be a rocket scientist or a world-changing lawyer or something like that, right? The moment that women faced a wall of elder women telling them how to do and what to be, Now, for a lot of the males, we're like, whatever, yapping is my daughter's new phrase. Or you're just yapping, or she just this is a yapping thing, which is actually very funny, and not entirely wrong at times, more than at times. So, the moment that women face this wall of elder females telling them what to do, they generally will go along with it because that's how culture got transmitted, and that's how they were protected, and that's how men had something to fight for, and that's how we survived. So getting mad at women for that which allowed us to survive, I don't understand it. It is a form of spiritual suicide. It's saying that women should have the same resistance to propaganda that men do, but if they did, we wouldn't have survived because culture is a form of propaganda transmitted through women, imprinted upon infants and toddlers, which give men something to fight for, protect women, and allow us to stand and survive in a world of warring tribes. I wish women weren't the way that they are is a desire for non-existence. I'm not kidding about this. I'm deadly serious about this. Being frustrated with female nature, the female nature that in combination with male nature got us to the very top of the food chain and had us evolve from single-celled organisms over the long run over 4 billion years to the most brilliant and creative species the universe has ever seen, or at least that we've ever seen in the universe. I mean, maybe there's some bacteria on Mars, but that's not much progress. So getting mad at female nature rather than saying the problem is not female nature, the problem is political and media power. If you can get women to vote for candidate X, right? If you can get women to vote for candidate X, then you are in control of trillions of dollars and all of the massive machinery of the modern state. So guess what? You are going to bend every atom of your being if you want that unholy political power, and a lot of people do, most people do. If you want that unholy political power, you're going to bend every fiber of your being into manipulating, controlling, and hooking into women's more groupthink and more conformity, which again, as men, we can say, well, that's just terrible. And it's like, no, it's not. It's why we're all here. It's why we won, not just as a species, but as individual tribes. So getting mad at women when women are controlled because women have particular susceptibilities to being controlled, which is, again, how we evolved, why there's culture, why there's art, why there's politeness, why there's moral standards. Morals are transmitted through the female in general, because it has to be imprinted on babies and toddlers that are largely ignored by men. Morality comes from the female. Practicality comes from the male. And the two together, right? Women give life meaning. Men make sure that life can continue, right? Women are what we go hunting for, and what we advance for, and what we build houses for, and what gives our life meaning is the provision for women and children as men. And as men are less married and less providing, meaning is going down, depression is going up, anxiety is going up, unhappiness is going up. Because as men, we are there to protect and provide. And if we don't find women we can do that with, then we are not happy. So yeah, the fact that women have this kind of groupthink, and I talked about this from a male perspective, I understand that it's annoying. It annoys me from time to time, but I have to sort of remember why we're all here in this groupthink, you know, the women in the circle, you know, Gen Z boss in a mini, this sort of chanting and circle stuff. That's, I hate to say it, you know, because it sounds ridiculous in a way. I hope I've made a reasonable case for it. No, that's culture. That's how this stuff gets reproduced. Now, the challenge, of course, is, and this is why women tend to be in charge of daycares, women tend to be in charge of kindergarten and primary school. And this was the case even when I was little, because that's how culture gets transmitted and imprinted. And I remember as a kid, you know, growing up in England in the late 60s and the early 70s, a lot of women around, and they transmitted this, you know, love of England and forward for St. George and the glories of war and the necessity of fighting and the brave and noble island and so on, fighting against the Nazis and the Battle of Britain. And all of that stuff was inculcated in me, and as was religion, right? It was my aunts in particular, who we just had to go to church, no ifs, ands, or buts. And the men were, you know, kind of, okay, I guess we'll go to church and I guess I'll dress up. But the women were adamant and resolute in this. You must go to church. You must say your prayers. You must read this. You must, like, and there was no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And the men were like, okay, yeah, we'll go and so on, right? Now, of course, the women say, well, but the men are running the church and the men are doing the preaching and so on. And I get all of that. I understand all of that. I don't want to overload you with all that stuff. So that's a bit of a topic for another time. And I recognize that you say, but the women define the culture, but the men tend to contribute the most to culture with sculpture and paintings and plays and so on. Although novel writing is novel writing is largely female endeavor as a whole. So, or significantly female endeavor as a whole. So the fact that there's groupthink and that older women amplified by the media are telling younger women, you have to do this, you have to do that, and they're programming the younger women. Well, that's how we have culture. That's how we have any stability in human societies. The older women the mothers inflict on the babies and toddlers, and then the older women inflict on the mothers and the babies and toddlers the continuity of culture, which is not invented but inflicted, bribed, and rewarded. And the culture is to some degree defined by exceptional men, but it is transmitted through the female, which is why if you want to destroy a culture, you separate the females from the babies. It's honestly, it is not any more complicated than that. You separate the females from the babies. And you do that by hacking females' conformity in order to get them to say, the good is now to hand my precious babies and toddlers over to strangers to raise. And that way, and that the government is always, always, always trying to separate mothers from their children and put the children in the hands of the state. And this, you know, it was less than a century between the American Revolutionary War and the imposition of government education, right? Because it was a Protestant nation, Catholics were pouring in, and they said, well, we've got to have the government control the education because we want to preserve the Protestant culture. And then it wasn't that long, of course, before the government education was used to destroy the Protestant culture. We've sort of seen this a million times before, so that's inevitable. And of course, it is frustrating as a thinker that all these decisions were made long before I was born, and we're just trying to manage the effects of it, right? So once you have the government take over the raising of children, then the government can inflict whatever culture it wants. The power mongers can oppose the existing cultures. They can imprint whatever they want on the children, which is why totalitarian regimes are always trying to get their hands on children. This is all the way back to, I did a 4-hour presentation on Plato, which you can find at fdrpodcast.com. Don't forget to install. You can do that now. But if you listen to my presentation on Plato, I talk about how in Plato's Republic, the children are raised collectively. The children are raised by the state. And that's inevitable. That's if you get pair-bonded, if you get children who otherwise would be pair-bonded with their mothers to pair-bond with the state, with teachers, which is to say nobody at all, then there's this free-floating anxiety I talked about in the show last night that can be weaponized against the enemies of the state. And because people kind of half-pair-bond with the state, criticism of the state awakens the defensive parental alter egos and so on, right? So yeah, men tend to enforce conformity through violence, and women tend to enforce conformity through praise and punishment, emotional praise and punishment, through affection and ostracism. So for A girl stepping out of line is punished with you're not invited to the parties. You don't get the sleepovers. You don't, you know, you're excluded. You're ostracized. You're gossiped about, which is kind of tortuous for women. So the girls step in line, right? The mean girls, right? And all of that. Well, mean girls is culture. Like it or not, I'm just telling you, mean girls is culture. And boys tend to enforce conformity through violence, right? So the typical example would be if you say something bad about my mother, I will punch you, right? I will punch you as a boy, right? And so for men, because men can deal better with ostracism than women can, biologically, I think evolutionarily, because men can deal better with ostracism than women can, men's standards have to be enforced through violence, right? And women's enforcement tends to be emotional punishment and reward, which is mocking you for future reproductive success or failure. So if you look at World War One, and I'll sort of end on this example. If you look at World War One, there was always this question I had as a kid. I was very much into studying and learning about war when I was a kid, actually quite a little kid too. I certainly was doing it by boarding school, so at the age of six. And I remember, of course, reading about the horrors of World War One, which was really the end of the West as it was constituted, and everything after that has been death throes. And I've got a whole presentation, The Truth About World War One, or just Truth About the First World War. I can't remember which one I used, but you can search for that again, fdrpodcast.com. The big question is, well, why would the young men go over the trench wall into no man's land under withering machine gun fire? Why? Why would they do that? Now, part of it, of course, was patriotism and the glory of God and the somewhat onward Christian soldier's version of Valhalla, which is to get to heaven through the protection of the tribe, or death in the service of protecting the tribe. But there was, of course, foundationally a much more practical reality, which was that you had officers who shot the men who didn't go over. So if you went over into no man's land, maybe you'd survive the machine gun fire. But if you didn't go over, you'd get shot by your commanding officer. So you might as well try, right? Because you're going to die. You'll take the chance of survival over the certainty of death. So that's how it was enforced by the men. I'll shoot you if you don't go. For the women, though, it's the white feather campaign, which is when there was a young man of military age walking around the streets in England, not in any military paraphernalia. In other words, if he was considered to be a coward who hadn't signed up, women would hand him white feathers, which would be the marker of you're a coward. And this would drive a lot of men to go and enlist, because if the women are organized against you and, oh, this guy's a coward, don't mate with him, you might as well go to the front. Because let's say on the front you have a 50% chance of surviving, but women will mate with you afterwards, then your genes have a 50% chance of reproducing. If the women organize and tell everyone, and you, because remember, the internet was the local community back then. So if you were then marked as a coward and women wouldn't mate with you, then your genes are going to die, right? So you'll take a 50% chance of survival by going to the front rather than having women collectively organize against you to reproduce with you, in which case you don't have any chance of reproductive survival, so you might as well go and try it there. So I just really want to, once you see that side of women and you stop judging women by male standards, just as women should stop judging males by female standards, when you see that and you understand that, you can understand as well that the deplatforming that I went through, which was to a large degree executed by women, when you understand the deplatforming is a goal to create conformity and thus survival, it is not morally just, and I understand that it's misapplied and so on. But I can't get overly mad at the impulse, because that's why we're all here, and that's why we have a culture to look back on, and that's why we have developed art and morals and literature and all kinds, science even to some degree, all kinds of wonderful things have been generated by women's commitment to transmitting culture through soft punishment and reward. And so the fact that it was applied against me, I understand where it's coming from. It is misused, but that's a function of power, not of female nature. Female nature is as beautiful as the day is long. Male nature is as beautiful as the day is long. And it is the corruption of power that has us turn on each other rather than rescuing each other, which is the ultimate opposition to hierarchy. So I hope this helps if you find what I'm saying valuable and helpful, and I hope that you do. Learning how to love women in a state of society is tough. If it's any consolation, learning to love men in a state of society is also tough. But we should not turn on each other because we are trapped in a zoo, the zoo being the mindset of power, and we should work to disengage from those thoughts and find sweet reason so that finally our culture can be rational. And that is a beautiful goal for me, to find a culture that conforms to reason, virtue, and evidence. And once we get that, we'll be free, I believe, as a species, forever and ever. Amen. Thank you so much. freedomain.com/donate. Take care, my friends. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.